Hello and welcome to another episode of Such Stuff, the podcast from Shakespeare's Globe. This week we're bringing you another episode from our series on Shakespeare and race. Last week's episode looked at the way whiteness has dominated the way we read the works of Shakespeare, from the first moment we pick up a play. In this week's episode, we're going to take a closer look at the education system and how we're teaching our next generations. The way we teach and learn is so important for the way we understand the world. If that education is permeated with this idea that whiteness is the norm and everything else is the other, that is what we take out into the world. And when it comes to Shakespeare, it means generations are brought up with a narrow set of ideas about what Shakespeare's plays mean, who they are for, and why they matter. More and more, across schools, universities, and drama schools, we're hearing calls to decolonise the curriculum. In this episode, we'll be exploring what that means and what a decolonised curriculum might look like. And of course, we'll be asking what that means for the way we learn the works of Shakespeare. The audio quality on this isn't quite what we'd normally offer you, the perils of working and recording from home, but please do stick with us. Here's our very own Professor Farah Karim Cooper.
In this episode of our podcast series on whiteness in education, we explore the ways in which systemic racism permeates the educational context. Our very own Dr. Will Tosh speaks to Dr. Shona Hunter, reader in the Carnegie School of Education at Leeds Beckett University, where she is a member of the Center for Race Education and Decoloniality. She and Will discuss her work in the center and on critical whiteness studies, an academic discipline that examines how whiteness works as a formation of power and how it feeds into racism. We'll also hear from playwright, actor, and recently head of acting at Arts Ed London, Stephen Kavuma, who is also founder of the Diversity School Initiative, which was set up to address underrepresentation and diversity in drama schools in the UK. I sat down with him via Zoom to discuss his own experiences of drama school and the structural racism at the heart of actor training in this country. So I'm here with Stephen Kavuma. Stephen, thank you so much for agreeing to participate in our podcast. It's so great to have you. And I know you've been involved in Globe events in the past, so it's really great to welcome you back. I met you really because of your work in the Diversity School. And I know that you're really passionate about drama school training. So I wanted to ask you, first of all, how you would characterize the whiteness of drama school training in the UK.
That's a really good question, and I don't think there is a set answer for that question. I think it's sort of about the curriculum. It's about the people who are there. It's about the building, the space. It's, you know, also about the language people use. And that whiteness has sips in through many things. I don't know, there's something very uncomfortable being at drama schools and knowing that you're in a space that doesn't facilitate for you. And there's also something very comfortable in knowing that you are a minority inside that place, that school, that thing, because there's so many other people who don't look like you. When I was at Central, I was the only black male in a year of 90 students. So already I had to navigate my way around that school and think about, okay, how is it going to work? Like, what conversations would I be having? And then when we were talking about race, and it always felt like I was that person who was defending my right to exist or my right to be. And then often, really weird, bizarrely, it kind of steered onto the conversation about, like, the diversity of the institution. So it was like, okay, cool, white people know that there's a problem, but nobody really wants to do anything about it. But yeah, I think whiteness in drama schools is about many things. There's the culture of drama schools that is so white, you know, that enables white people. And then there is the language and the building itself. Like, for example, when you walk into Central, you see these steps. On these steps are the famous actors and directors or people who graduated at Central who are white. And then when you go up the steps, you're greeted by this amazing portrait of the founder of the school that has gold frames, which straight away tells you about class. Then you get into the corridor and you see this massive glass golden chandelier that again represents class and represents whiteness. Already you're in a space that you know, oh crap, I've never been around this space before and this space isn't facilitated for me. Yeah, it's very uncomfortable.
Did you get a sense that there was an awareness about your feelings of alienation in that way in the school?
At times I did, but also I think people didn't want to hear it. So there's a sense of knowing that there's a problem, but nobody really wanting to address it or unpick it or even talk about it. So then you always feel like you're the person who's having to drag or push or fight for having this conversation, when really and truly it shouldn't be you, because you're not the one who made the problem. You're just there to study or to be a student. So you unpicking the problem as the student really shouldn't be your job, because you didn't create it.
Yes. So, I mean, the next thing I was going to ask you about were those specific challenges as a student from start to finish. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, for example, the texts that you were working with. And you said something about language as well. I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, so I did an applied theatre course in playwriting at the school, and we were in lectures and sometimes seminars, and I said that, look, a lot of these people that we're referencing, or a lot of people that we're looking at and focusing on, are white people, and they don't cater or facilitate towards me and my peers. So there was one challenge there, and trying to talk to a school and trying to be like, please, can you change your curriculum? Please, can you fit your curriculum in line with me? Because I don't need to know about that person. I need to know about this person, because maybe my dissertation might be about myself or like my race and how I navigate. So I need to know to educate myself. You are building an institution that educates. You need to educate me. I know a lot of my peers who are on the acting course kind of felt like a lot of what they were doing, the monologues or plays that they were doing, were written by white men, they were directed by white men, and they never got a chance to really work with directors who were black or brown, or directors who were from other backgrounds. And then also, I think for me, a lot of times as a student, there was something very uncomfortable seeing black students in these very classical plays. The kind of plays that the Shakespeare or the Chekhovs, that in those plays describe blackness as dirty or as a crime. And then you got black actors in those plays, and then they're being referenced to, and then it's like, there isn't a care for me as a black audience watching this. There isn't a care for those black people in those plays. And that's when I was like, okay, cool, this school is really neglecting the care for black people, which was kind of one of the challenges and one of the things that you kind of want to see the school understand and face.
That is a challenge with historical texts, isn't it? And if you're teaching it, there's a responsibility you have to understand the language and to sort of open up those conversations in the rehearsal room, in the classroom, about how this feels and what it means and why we're still doing it and why we're still saying these things in these plays. And I think you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of faculty in, you know, higher education across the board don't have the language to have those conversations.
No. And they don't have the lived experience to be able to have those conversations. I brought up something in my first year about wanting to learn more about race and race in applied theatre, and then we were studying colonization in applied theatre, and where we were studying it, we were in this boardroom, and at the time it had their famous alumni around, and all the faces were white faces. So I was in this room, there were two black people in this lesson and surrounded by this class of all white people, and then we were learning about colonization, and the person who was teaching us colonization was this white guy. And it's things like that where you just have to take yourself out of it and think, like, is this actually happening? This is actually crazy, like, you can't make it up. Yeah, so there isn't anyone in there who know about these conversations or who feel understand it or are able to do justice to teaching them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Can you tell me about the diversity school and you know, what it does and why you set it up.
Yeah, so the diversity school was set up because there was a real need to put diversity and representation in drama schools on the agenda. So I felt being alienated. I felt having to fight for my right to be there. I felt, yeah, excluded out of the curriculum and out of the student body. So I wanted for us to have those conversations and be able to say to the school, why should I feel like this? And what are you going to do about it to change it? So then kind of set up Diverse School to do that, to have that conversation with schools. Obviously, over like 4 or 5 years, it has now grown, and it's an organisation that supports students to empower them to be able to ask or feel like they can ask uncomfortable questions. Because I think there's that thing about being a student, especially in a drama school, but being grateful that you're given a place and being reminded that somebody can replace you, that 1,000 people auditioned, or, you know, 10,000 people auditioned, and I selected you, so you should be happy that you are here. So automatically that kind of silences you, so you don't feel that you have that voice or able to speak on top of all the other stuff, on top of race, on top of class and, you know, disability. So we kind of wanted to make sure that students were able to question their training in a way that wasn't the conventional way of doing so. So like if they wanted to have a protest, they could have a protest. If they wanted to have a petition, they can do that. And they wouldn't have feel like anything's going to happen to them for doing that, because that's their right, you know, that they're paying there to be there. So of course they should be able to question their training. But also the other thing was to be able to support drama schools in order to do these things. And we identified from the get-go, like, the change that we wanted to see was about structural change. So it was about the curriculum changing, it was about the teachers changing, the freelance teachers changing. So we kind of identified that from the beginning. And a lot of what we've been doing is working closely with 5 drama schools on how they can improve and structurally change policy, but also to understand these problems. Because a lot of, you know, institutions have heads, principals, who have no idea of these things. That's why Gavin Henderson was able to say what he said at Dear White Central, where he said that he thinks that bringing in more black students or students of colour would put the quality of the school down. But there's no one else who's challenging him, who's saying, actually, Gavin, that's a really racist thought, and we should be actually striving for diversity, because diversity is the thing that makes us great, right? It's the thing that improves us. So the more people we have around the table, the more thoughts and ideas we have. It's been really interesting kind of seeing how we were 4 years ago and where we are now. And I think when we started, there was a difficult thing of trying to put this thing on the agenda. It's now on the agenda. People know it. And now the kind of work we're having to do is to push and push and push for that change. It's already happening. It's not a coincidence that, you know, ArtsEd have Julie Spencer and Lambda have Sarah Frankham and Guildhall have Ola. Like, all these people who've been pushing for change and doing it and are doing it. You know, if you look at ArtsEd, they have, like, massively improved in terms of their diversity, and Julie has been spearheading that, which is amazing to see. But we can now see the change in some ways, but there's still more pushing that we need to do.
Yes, I mean, you must feel quite hopeful then, if you're seeing that kind of shift in 5 years. That's extraordinary. So thinking about what we've been discussing in terms of the drama student experience, and when finishing now, so obviously due to the pandemic, theaters are in a crisis and they're thinking about their existential lives and whether or not they're actually going to exist beyond this pandemic. So I'm just wondering if you could say a little bit about what you think about the future of theater in terms of representation, given the situation that we're in. When theaters start to recover, what will you see? What do you hope to see regarding representation?
I mean, I hope to see theatres have listened, and I hope that theatres have used this time to readdress their problems with everything that's happened, I think, you know, COVID happening is one thing, so that gives you time. But even the whole thing that's happened with George Floyd kind of gives you time to understand and unpick these things. And so I hope that theatres have done that work. And when we come back, we can come back to theatres and institutions that look like the communities that we live in. But I don't think it will happen. And I'm really pessimistic because I think a lot of theatres right now are in need of making money. And the problem with this industry, it never sees the work in terms of diversity or, you know, in terms of black work or brown work. It never sees that work as able to make box office like hits. It never sees that. It always sees it as a risk. And that's why people will say, I'm taking a chance on you. We really want to give you this opportunity. And we're never in the mainstream. So I think with everything that's happened now, I don't think we're going to be in the mainstream. I think it's going to push us right back. We're going to have to push and push and push. Before COVID hit, theatres were taking amazing steps to do this work. And they were, you know, working with, commissioning artists that look and sound like us and the stories that mirror our lived experiences. But I think we're going to see that go backwards because it, to them, that work doesn't make money in the way as, like, I don't know, putting, you know, celebrities going to sell tickets. Let's put him Chekhov. Chekhov's going to sell. So I think we're going to go backwards. But I hope that theatres have taken this time because I know theatre is going to come back. So people saying, oh, I don't know if it's going to come back. It's a ridiculous question. It is going to come back. But it's a matter of how we come back as an industry that's more important and how we make and open our doors so that they're more inclusive and accessible. In terms of film and theatre, film looks and sounds more like us. You know, I know I'm not saying it's amazing. I'm not saying it's brilliant. TV and film have their challenges. But in terms of looking at the catalogue or the canon, film and TV is kind of leading on that. So if film and TV was dying, there'll be more of an uproar. But because theatre isn't accessible, there is an uproar in our communities to save this thing because it's never reflected us. Like, why should we save it? Why should we be out protesting? So I think theatre needs to take this time to really look about how they can be more inclusive and accessible so that everyone feels like theatre is for them, you know?
So do you think a lot of those solidarity statements that came out after the murder of George Floyd, do you think that that was just bandwagoning?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, it was. And it's really sad. It's so sad because at the beginning of when it happened, we, black people, people who have faced racism, have put ourselves in the very uncomfortable positions to do the labour and the work when it first took place. And theatres wanted to speak to us or theatre wanted to discuss it or whatever. And they said they're going to readdress it and they're going to do it. But since then, lots of theatres and organisations have been very, very quiet. We don't know if they even have an action plan. We don't know what they're going to do in terms of these issues. It's been like tweet something, change your DP, hashtag something and then be silent. And this thing that's come up called Pull Up or Shut Up, which is an amazing thing that's come up. I don't know if you've seen it, but all these stats are coming out and they show us what we've always seen, what we've always known. So there's something very deeply saddening about seeing it in black and white. White people know that some things you just got to do. You know, you don't need a diversity specialist to tell you you need to program more black work, you need to work with more black artists, you need to develop black artists or black directors. That's basically common sense, right? The fact that you get a diversity specialist is just to prolong change because they don't want to do it. So I think it's even that, seeing organizations take part in that, but yet still not give a detailed kind of action plan or them wanting to address this seriously and take it on, just shows where we might be in the future.
Yeah, it's a hard reality, but it is a reality. And you're absolutely right about, well, if we get a diversity specialist, then, you know, it looks like we're doing something. You know, it's really easy to interpret it that way.
Absolutely. It's a lot easier than doing the work.
Yeah, absolutely. So the question that we're asking everybody that participates in our podcast is, do you have any thoughts about how to decolonize Shakespeare? And the reason I ask this question is because, you know, it's something that as the head of research at the Globe, who works on Shakespeare and race, it's something that I've been wanting to do for a long time. But a lot of people don't know what that means and how you go about. And you know, you may not need to talk about Shakespeare, but talking about decolonizing the canon or, you know, the texts that students in drama school and universities and schools are constantly being fed. How do we begin to decolonize that?
I think we need to break it apart. I think we need to completely start afresh or anew. I think the problem is that a lot of these things, Chekhov, Shakespeare, the Globe, the Old Vic, the National, they've always seen as if they belong to a certain group of people. So even when you attempt to decolonize it, those groups of people will be, oh my God, why are you doing that? That's mine. So then you have to make it in a way that sits or has to include them. But actually, I think you just need to break it all apart and start afresh and be like, what is this? Why are we doing this play? What does this play represent? What does it mean? I've never seen Shakespeare as someone I can relate to, and I'm a playwright. And that's crazy. But because in terms of education and secondary school, primary school, then drama school, Shakespeare has always been taught as it's something that belongs to white people. It's even the way we perform Shakespeare, you know, with RP and with people acting as if they're performing in front of the Queen. And it's like, what does this text mean? Like, what is Shakespeare trying to say? Like, why are we doing this play? What does it mean? What does it relate to us here? Rather than just doing it because I like it and I think it's going to sell a lot of tickets if we put this famous actor in it. So I think we need to completely break it apart. I think with actor training, I think we need to look at why we do Shakespeare in drama school. Why is that necessary? And what does it do for the actor going out of drama school? Why are we training them? I think there needs to be a real, like, radical look at actor training and who it really kind of fits and suits. I think we sort of know those answers. We know it suits white people. We know it's catered for them because the way they perform it or because the way it's been told. You know, when you look at the Globe was sort of this space that was like, you know, working class people. It wasn't for the middle class, the elite. You know, Shakespeare didn't write like that. In the sense that we're doing Shakespeare like that and we're constantly being told, this is who Shakespeare is. This is how Shakespeare should be performed. This is the history. We're constantly being told that Shakespeare is not for you, you know. So even decolonizing it, I don't think it works really. I think we need to look at Shakespeare as if Shakespeare is a unknown playwright in order to do Shakespeare properly. Does that make sense?
Totally. To completely dislodge him from the 400 years of construction. Yeah.
Absolutely. The fact that this man sort of represents our culture is wrong. Yeah, he doesn't. Yeah.
That is brilliant. I want to thank you for your time and thank you for all the work that you're doing. It's amazing.
Thank you for all your work you're doing as well, Farah.
You take care.
You too. Have a lovely day.
Thinking about these experiences and how to make broad, lasting change across the sector, our very own Dr. Will Tosh got in touch with Dr. Shona Hunter to take a broader look at what it is about our education system that is broken and how this idea of whiteness is part of that. They also chatted about what that slightly abstract term, decolonising the curriculum, might look like in reality for the education sector.
So, Dr. Shona Hunter, can you start, Shona, by telling us what whiteness studies is and why it's important?
Okay, so I think the first thing to say is I would always put the critical in front of it. For the most part now, most people who are interested in scholarly ideas around whiteness would use that notion of the critical to differentiate what we're interested in from kind of a political allegiance with whiteness as a kind of political formation that maybe we'll talk about a little bit more in a moment. It's an area of study that is interested in trying to understand how whiteness works as a formation of power. There's lots of different ways into that. So identities of whiteness, kind of white cultures, but usually, and certainly from a critical perspective, always how this maps into and relates to the issue of racism and structural issues of racial disadvantage are kind of at the core of that. It's probably important to flag up an ambivalence to the notion of whiteness studies and critical whiteness studies as a field of study. Really, one of the key bones of contention is around the kind of reinstatement of a position of dominance for white people. So this bringing a scholarly focus onto whiteness actually may be problematic in that it re-centres whiteness, which is already kind of a frame of dominance for social life. I suppose where should our concerns lie when we are exploring matters of social justice and when we're addressing issues of systemic inequality? So the issue of the way in which white studies might get kind of tangled up with or be understood as having some sort of an allegiance with kind of white supremacy, that's probably less the concern in relation to the way in which critical whiteness studies has developed. And it really is more about this kind of white narcissism, which can be about reinstating the constant desire to explore all issues from the point of view of people who have always been able to define kind of history, if you like.
In that case, is there a sense that the field of study is asking us to explore that sense of privileged narcissism that says a white perspective is seen as the default? So let's interrogate that assumption of default rather than just allow it to stand.
Yes, absolutely. A key concern is around how do we explore issues of dominance in a way which recognises our bound upness. So I'm a white woman, that's something we haven't kind of talked about yet, but I am a white woman. There are constant sets of questions around that as a starting point, really. And indeed, it wasn't really my starting point, actually, getting into these issues. I certainly didn't start reading about race and think, what about white folks? My background, I started off in policy studies. Social research, which was an important part of policy and policy making, was very interested in mapping and understanding the other. So creating another. So I was very interested in the ways in which we were doing social justice research, which were actually reinforcing and creating images of people who were unequal systemically, but also potentially figures of victimhood. It's power that interests me, thinking about radically reforming systems of power. I mean, that's really where my interests lie. Really, an interest in whiteness takes us to a set of issues which is actually about how white supremacy, and I use that term to explore the whole of the context we're all living in, actually frames our understandings of what it is to be human, what it is to be in an institutional space, what it is to be a learner. But these things are really deeply encoded in our understandings of humanness.
Well, that seems like quite an interesting way to sort of nudge the door into education and syllabus and curriculum. And an ongoing debate is to decolonise the curriculum, to think about texts and writers and forms of thinking that are not just in the white European mould, which I think lots of people have claimed is more challenging for the early modern period or for perhaps longer ago, where there isn't the latch of post-coloniality that people have had with literature since the 19th century. How does one decolonise a literature curriculum stretching back to 16th century and before, and how might that begin to help us think about Shakespeare?
Yeah, well, actually, I think that's really important to unearth that difference between ideas of post-coloniality, which, as you say, have been really helpful for us thinking about what I would call the heyday of whiteness, if you like. So whiteness, as we live it now, was historically really coming to its power at the height of the 19th century. And so we've got quite a lot of very explicit ways of thinking about whiteness as a position of dominance through state making, through colonialism. But I think what becomes really important from a decolonial point of view is to go back further than that, actually. At the point that modernity started, so the Elizabethan exploration stroke pillaging stroke, basically the ground laying, if you like, of the capital colonial relations that we see then in the development of kind of slavery and that as a global system, are actually starting at the very point that Shakespeare certainly is kind of doing his work. So I think actually you've potentially got some really brilliant ins substantively, historically, that aren't necessarily explicitly talked about in the plays, although actually maybe they are, or they're coded there very heavily. So there's that, but I think there's also other things in relation to really thinking about how we decolonise the curriculum, really getting to grips with this understanding of modernity and how that structured our ideas of the human. It structured our ideas of exploration, of possession, who gets to own what. We start to develop our ideas of gender. Our contemporary ideas of gender have come about through historical colonial relations. All of these things were being created ideologically as part of these practices of kind of exploration and what have you. And
that's so fascinating to hear, because it also tallies with some of those takes on Shakespeare and early modern drama that says Shakespeare teaches everyone to be a human being. But actually, of course, what you're suggesting is the era that Shakespeare's living in is one in which all of these structures are beginning their process of being set up. I'm really struck by your approach to this through the lens of power, and power that, as you write, often kind of has lots of overlaps with white middle-class masculinity and middle-aged masculinity and establishment masculinity. And one of the objections, of course, to an undecolonized curriculum is the prevalence of kind of white maleness on the syllabus. So what do we do, if you like, with the fact that Shakespeare's there, the kind of monolith that needs challenging?
I don't know whether this is the thing to say on the Globe podcast, but there does need to be a really quite serious expansion of what we understand to be kind of art and culture. How do we understand culture? Do we understand it as something that is obvious, or is it something that's hidden? And how do we do that work of exposure? But I also think there's something about practices and there's something about measurement. And by that, what I mean is a key part of any decolonizing practice is that it is a practice. It's about doing education, learning, pedagogy in a completely different kind of way than we are used to. Because, and again, it comes back to what are our ideas of pedagogy rooted in? Well, they're rooted in our understandings of what it is to be an ideal type person, an ideal type learner who goes out into the world in the way that we want them to. So I think if we can start to unpack through different sorts of teaching practices and actually rethinking the dynamics of power in educational spaces. So what we mean by educating, how we actually do that, who has the power in that process, what sort of questions do we ask, and what sort of materials do we bring together in that process, then I think all of those things become part of a broader decolonising process. I think this issue of measurement then becomes quite important. So ideas of excellence, success in the academic context, what we're actually looking to produce at the end of an educational encounter looks a particular way if we have whiteness and dominant ideas about how we come out of education systems looking and behaving the way that we imagine is appropriate for the given society we're in, well, that there is something there that's about reproducing ourselves through the process of education. And I think if we start to think about education as maybe undoing ourselves, then we can get to a place of kind of different relationship to coloniality. And that would be potentially very dismantling of whiteness. But we need to be having those conversations explicitly. You know, a very kind of common one at the moment is hair. What's good hair? Well, we all know there's a code there, right? When we're talking about good and bad hair, and that code is racialized. So that's the sort of mapping, the sort of cultural mapping that we need to start to do. So developing a racial literacy that enables us to understand good and bad, things that we understand as good and bad or right and proper, as actually deeply racialised and usually deeply coded as white. So this is how race works, really.
And this is probably a very hard question, but what would a decolonialised education or university education that brought into its very structures an idea of kind of deracializing look like? Is there something that can, that you could I appreciate this is not an easy question.
Well, you know, it's kind of classic, isn't it? Because I can certainly tell you what it wouldn't look like, which is most contemporary university spaces, sadly. But this is about us understanding the products of a society that reproduces itself, you know. I think it's very difficult to describe what something would look like, the actual contours of it, partly because we are so steeped, and the we there I'm using very explicitly. So I'm talking about myself as a white woman, but I am also talking about myself as somebody who has grown up for the most part in the context of the global north, right? And in a world that's globally colonially created. So it becomes very difficult to see in advance of doing the world differently. I think the first thing that I would say we need to be able to do, and this sounds so deceptively simple, I think, is not to be structured in our everyday practices through the sorts of spatial dynamics that we're used to, actually. We need to really be able to allow ourselves to work freely. So, I mean, I think it's interesting. This is probably one of my romanticisations about drama. Stage. But actually, it is about play, I think. It is about really pushing ourselves, constantly push ourselves outside of our comfort zone, and to basically deal in difference, but deal in different practices. I suppose the other thing that I haven't really maybe made clear is that race and whiteness, so our dynamics of racialization and of coloniality and how that works now, they're relational. Actually, if you allow yourselves to reconfigure spaces differently, then you can end up with, I think, relationships which are not power free. They're never power free. They're never comfortable. But spaces where you can question what power dynamics are framing that space, and when you can start to name those collectively. And I think the way we think about educational spaces at the moment, certainly in formal educational contexts, that feels really quite scary. The idea of kind of coming into a room and all of the people in that room being allowed to explore how they feel power is working in that room, and then to start unpacking that and think about how that frames the practices, how that frames how you can speak to each other, how that frames how people even move bodily in a room. The body in our educational spaces is not given the ability to breathe, and whiteness, it works through our bodies. It's absolutely, utterly embodied. So, I mean, in a way, for me, drama, which, again, my romanticisation of aspects of drama, but certainly the globe, you know, you would have really brilliant ways to engage with how the body moves in a space and what that means in relation to race, you know. Race works on the body, it works through the body. And then this isn't just about touch, and it's not just about the visual. It's about how we take up space. And it's even about our kind of habits, you know, just inserting a conversation and an acknowledgement of the body in formal educational spaces would be an absolutely fundamental part of starting to really decolonize. We can't decolonize just by talking about stuff. It's completely impossible.
I was going to ask, actually, where do you see this work happening already? What are the ways that researchers can work together to pull out some kind of consistent threads of critical whiteness?
Well, the work that I've been doing as founder, kind of leader of White Spaces, that really brings together scholars, activists, professionals, as well as academics together to think about how whiteness works in institutional spaces, but our understanding of the institution is very expanded. So we understand institutions as maybe the family, or, I mean, the church is a very traditional one, but as well as formal institutional spaces. One of the things that's been really useful in developing that knowledge is partly around this the notion, I suppose, of play again, or of moving in and out of your comfort zone. So it's completely interdisciplinary, all working together to kind of push one another to think very expansively about what whiteness is. So you get away from this idea of thinking about whiteness or about racialization as an identification, so as an identity. It's actually part of a system of power, and you then get into really starting to unpack what that system of power is, how that works, how it's sustained across all aspects of life, and how it can also be disrupted in all sorts of ways that we don't imagine. And it really is a tracing project, I think. We have to understand these dynamics kind of globally because of this situation of the global colonial that we're in. And then that takes us into all sorts of interesting directions around capitalism, anti-capitalism, you know.
Well, we need further series, I suspect, in that case. Yes. That was so brilliant. Thank you so much.
That's it from us, but we'll be back next week with another episode in our Shakespeare and Race series, when we'll be taking a closer look at our stages and how whiteness dominates the stories we tell, the actors we see, and the way our theatre spaces are set up. You've been listening to Such Stuff with me, Imogen Greenberg, Professor Farah Karim Cooper, and Dr. Will Tosh. To find out more about Shakespeare's Globe, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'll be back soon with more stories from Shakespeare's Globe, so subscribe wherever you get this podcast from.